This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia, conversations with Asia's leading movers, shakers, thinkers, and provocateurs. This episode is part two of my interview with Eric Rosenkranz. Eric is the former vice chairman of Focus Media China and now founder of the advisory firm E3.
And so you have to be aware of the need to pivot, and you need to be able to make that decision to pivot, which sometimes involves breaking a lot of eggs.
If you heard last episode, you'll recognize his voice and may remember his extraordinary story about the billion-dollar startup that came out of elevators in China. Among other things, Eric has cast himself as a mentor to some of Southeast Asia's most promising young entrepreneurs. He's the guy folks turn to in hopes of taking their game to the next level. In our last episode, he shared with us the story of how a combination of good timing and right pedigree landed him in a media company that took wing. From there, we moved into a discussion on the art of mentoring and considered some of the dilemmas faced by today's Southeast Asian startups. Eric, this is where, I mean, this is how I know you as a mentor, right? I mean, I've seen you guide people on all fronts. I mean, you've been incredibly helpful to me through the years, you know, going and sitting down when I've got a business idea or a problem or a circumstance. You've been there to kind of, and you ask extraordinary great questions, which is interesting that the tables are turned right here because I'm supposed to be asking the questions now. But, you know, this is how I know you. And then you also were affiliated with the Chicago Booth School, and you were mentoring and guiding and working with some of the graduate students there. This mentoring theme has been a big piece for you. Did that come in only after you left advertising, or is that just a theme that carried through your entire career?
I would say it's something that happened more with age, because when I started out my career, I was always the youngest guy in the room. So I was never mentoring anybody. I was always pushing other people to show that I was the smartest and I was the best and all, which got me into a lot of trouble, by the way. But when I retired from advertising, now I'm 52, and now suddenly I'm finding myself with a lot of younger people who are passionate about their business, who are ready to work 24/7, who have a deep understanding about their business, but like Jason Zhang, have never left China, like other people have never run a business, don't know about HR, don't know how to write a contract, don't know about legal stuff, and that's what I could bring to the party. So when I mentor people, and thank you, Steve, if you say I've mentored you a little bit, it was all done without a fee.
It's a fact, and I will pay you later.
usually charge for that. Yeah. People need different things out of mentoring. Okay, you don't need somebody to tell you what to do. You know what to do. You need somebody to kind of challenge your thinking, which is why when I work with you, Steve, I never tell you what to do. I ask you questions because you need to come up with it yourself, okay, because you're a mature businessman.
The Socratic method here.
Yes, but now I'm working with a 29-year-old Vietnamese guy. I can't do the same thing with him. He doesn't know enough for me to ask him those questions.
And when you say that, again, you're not being patronizing. You're just saying he's coming from a different place, a different time, a different stage of evolution in the economy or in the marketplace. Is that right?
Yeah. So one of the tricks about being a good mentor is not to do one size fits all, but to understand who are you mentoring, what are their needs, why did they ask for mentoring, and then how do you get them to be the best person they can be. So I try to take out the best of people. It's different things. We have another mutual friend. I won't say his last name, but his first name is Adam. I think you know the guy. Very mature, very successful businessman who has done one thing his whole career extremely well. But a couple of years ago, he wanted to start his own business. He had to do a startup. And he had no idea. He didn't know how to start a company. He didn't know how to write a contract. He had always worked for big corporations before. So I've been mentoring him, and that's been continuing now for 3 years, because he needed a certain thing. My 29-year-old Vietnamese guy needed something else. Another group, a couple of fellows who worked for me, one's an Australian, one's a Vietnamese, and they started their own company in Saigon.
A Vietnamese guy, yeah.
So two fellows who worked for me in one of my previous companies about 10 years ago, one's Vietnamese, one's an Australian, and they started their own company about 5 years ago in Saigon. And I would have lunch with the Australian guy, you know, when he came to Singapore every 3 or 4 months, and he would kind of, you know, just chat about his business, and I would make the appropriate comments. And one day he came to me and he said, "Eric, we're stuck. We've gotten to a certain level. We're really doing well. We don't know how to get to the next level, and we have all of these issues. Can you help us? And I said, for you, delighted to do it. Here's the deal. I won't charge you anything. Pay my expenses. I'll fly to Saigon, spend the day with you and your partner. We'll whiteboard everything. I'll get it done. I do a lot of things for friends where I don't charge them. I just, you know, this is my giving back because people do something for me. I wash your back. You wash my back. I do that a lot. So I flew to Saigon. Actually, it only took us a morning, 4 hours. At the end of the day, the Vietnamese guy said, Eric, I've had sleepless nights for the last 6 months worrying about these issues. And in 4 hours, you know, together, you know, it's not that I gave him the answer. We worked it out together. He said, together, you were able to guide us, and we answered all the questions. He said, I have one more question for you. How can we make this a permanent arrangement? So I became the chairman of that company. Mm-hmm. So my business model now is... I usually can't charge startups because they have no money to pay me. So I become the chairman of a company and I get shares in that company. So my compensation is tied to the results. If the company succeeds, I get money, and if it fails, I don't get anything.
Yeah.
You know what's so interesting about this? I mean, a lot of the work I do is with corporations, and mentoring is in such gross short supply these days. It's shocking to me how it's gone from these established, let's bring people up through the ranks, let's make sure we groom them and help them and train them and develop them. Increasingly, corporations are becoming short-sighted, and you don't have the same relationships that you had before, yet you turn to the startup community, and people like you and others are really gravitating towards the idea of mentoring younger, you know, sharp, capable, energized young entrepreneurs. It's almost like it's a mentoring in waiting. People can't do it in the corporate environment to the degree that they can in a startup environment. Is that what you're experiencing?
Absolutely, and I think you've made a very good point. Big corporations can't put a value on mentoring. They know that it's an important thing, but how do you value it? How do you put a monetary number? This is worth this much to me. I'm willing to pay this much.
Yeah.
A startup guy, if he's put his whole life into building a company and he knows he needs that mentorship, he'll pay anything for that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Getting back to Jason Jiang at Focus Media, he gave me a ton of shares in the company, which ended up being very valuable, but he wasn't giving me anything. I was making money for him. Without me, he couldn't succeed in his listing.
Yeah.
And what's so great when you say that, you don't say that with ego. You say that's in a very practical, straightforward way. It is what it is, and it was what it was.
Yeah. And that succeeded. Now, I have to say, I've mentored other startups that have failed.
No. Okay.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Now, let's talk about one that failed.
Okay.
And we'll bring in a new concept, the concept of the pivot. We've all, have your viewers heard or your listeners heard about
pivot? I know you want to talk about it, so I'm going to let you go with it. Go ahead.
Okay, well, that's the big concept these days in startups, which is I'm going to make an analogy now. I said earlier that when I left the corporate world, I started to do one thing, but I ended up doing something else. So my original idea was not to do mentorship. It was to do this strategic consulting for big companies, but I ended up being a startup mentor. That's a pivot, where you decide to do one thing, but you end up pivoting and do something else.
And is it being prepared and aware of the need to pivot that's important? Because I do, you're right, I see this with startups where they get so hell-bent and determined to follow through on the original plan, they miss it altogether.
Correct. And so you have to be aware of the need to pivot, and you need to be able to make that decision to pivot, which sometimes involves breaking a lot of eggs. So let me give you an example. About 6 or 7 years ago, two fellows who were based in Bangkok came to me, and they said they were going to start up a company to do call centers, okay? And they had both worked for call centers in the financial industry their whole careers, and now they were ready to do it on their own, okay? So I agreed to mentor them, become the chairman of the company, and we launched this boutique call center consultancy.
What were you taken by? Was it the call center idea, or was it the two entrepreneurs behind it?
Well, that is the best question you've asked yet. And it's a much bigger question than about this thing.
Well, I'll let you finish the story then. Go ahead.
Finish the story, but let's come back to that because it's a really important question.
Okay.
So we set up a company. It was first these three guys, and we eventually brought in other investors, and the company grew, blah, blah, blah. 7 years later, this is about a year or so ago, we realized the business model is broken. And the reason it's broken is that in this particular industry, nobody wants to outsource call centers. They all want to do it in-house. So all of the clients that we're building call centers for are saying, no, I'm just going to bring it in-house. I don't need you guys anymore. But now, we all know about call centers, and you call and you get some guy in Bangladesh, and blah, blah, blah. Okay, we all know about that. Now, Steve, do you know what the average turnover is in a call center?
Turnover in terms
of the callers, of the people who are answering the phones. Okay, what's the turnover in terms of percentage in 1 year?
I'm gonna say 220%.
Well, okay, most people will say like 20 or 30%.
I know, but you teed me up for that.
I know, I teed you up, you knew. The answer is 100%.
But it's still outrageous, unacceptable.
So every year, the entire thing turns over, 100%. Okay, we had gotten our turnover down to 12%. And the reason is that we realize most call centers will just, can you speak? Can you open your mouth? Okay, you're hired.
Yeah.
Okay. And the qualities that make somebody a good person to do calling are not in everybody. So what we did was we developed the psychological test where we could ask 50 questions and we would know 90% certainty whether somebody would make a successful caller or not. Okay, so instead of hiring everybody, we rejected most people, but the people we did hire stayed and were brilliant performers.
What was the secret sauce?
Can't tell you that.
Oh, you must.
No, can't.
Okay, but there was something.
But we had this test. It was developed by psychologists, and we tried a lot of different things, and we ended up figuring out what are the variables. Okay. But I'm not going to tell you what they are.
But that's not the point of the story.
But I still have one question before you finish up. So what you're saying is that is at the heart of the effective business model for call centers is reduction in retention, even more than, you know, the selling of the services to corporates or whatever the case may be.
Correct. So if you've got good callers, and they're not turning over, you've got more efficiencies, they're more effective, they're better at their jobs, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So we end up, we've got this brilliant group of callers. Other call centers contact us, so our competitors, and say, can we supply people to them?
Wow. All right.
So now we start hiring people for other call centers.
Recruitment, so not out of that call center, but basically applying the same rules of hiring and then shifting them over to other
employees. Correct. So we had set up now just a little division that was hiring people for our own group. Now we start hiring people for other call centers. Now, if we're rejecting 90% of the people, and the typical profile for a caller is, let's say, high school education. This was in Thailand, so making 10, 12,000 baht, call it $400 a month. Now we've got 90% of our people who have been rejected from being callers, but they could be Uber drivers, they could be bank tellers, they could work at McDonald's.
So here's the pivot.
So now we could start supplying high school graduates to industries that have nothing to do with call centers. So at the same time that our call center business is dying because our clients want to take it all in-house, we're finding a second life as a recruitment agency for high school graduates.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. I've never heard this story.
Okay.
Yeah, please.
So this pivot is actually it's been in the works for about a year now. Okay. So now we have to create a totally new company. It's no longer a division. It has to be a separate company. Now, let's go back to the two initial founders of the company. Okay, they're shareholders, they're founders, they're call center people. There's no room for them in this new company.
So what do you do?
It took a year, but as of December, and this interview is now happening in January, as of December, a month ago, in a very positive and polite way, they both resigned.
So are you saying that people have their natural limitations and that they can't pivot, but business models can? Or that certain people can pivot and that just so happens these two could not?
The latter.
Okay.
One of the guys made it very clear from the beginning that he had no interest in recruitment at all. And it was a very, you know, open dialogue, and he's moved on.
Yeah.
The other guy was very keen to work in recruitment, and we gave him 6 months, And we wanted him to succeed, and he just couldn't. It just wasn't in his mentality.
So, Eric, is this part of the mentoring thing then? And sometimes to mentor isn't just to simply positively encourage, is to kind of like provide practical feedback and direction, and so people don't end up going down a dead end.
Yeah, exactly. And in the end, I had to sit down with both of the founders, who I'd been very close with for 8 years, and say, look, you don't have a role in this new business model. And they knew it. They understood it. So we had to manage the transition in a very positive way.
Okay, great story. Interesting.
And by the way, they're both retain their shareholding in the company. Mm-hmm. They're both directors of the company. We're having a board meeting next week, and they're both going to participate, but they're no longer employees.
Right. So, Eric, this is part one. We're going to go into part two here, because honestly, I hadn't really expected this. And I think the way that you've taken this right now, we got a little piece, an understanding of how you pivoted in your own career, how you've helped others pivot as a mentor. But what I want to do in part two is I want to come back and I want to talk a little bit about the startup environment, how it's evolved, your role in it, and some of the observations. How's that sound to you?
Great. Sounds great. And we can get some more water.
Excellent. We'll be right back. I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. More from my conversation with Eric Rosenkrantz in a moment. I'm Steve Stein. My guest is Eric Rosenkrantz. Here's the second part of our conversation. I started by asking him what he looked for in a startup. I asked a question earlier, and I don't think we answered it, or I didn't give you a chance to answer it, which is, why did you choose that call center business? Was it the entrepreneurs or was it the business? Because you said ultimately in the pivot that the entrepreneurs were pushed out, albeit, you know, thoughtfully and diplomatically. So what is the answer to that question?
The biggest mistake any investor makes, and this is incredibly true about funding startups, is investing in ideas rather than people. Ideas are a dime a dozen. A great idea doesn't make a great company. It's all about the people. And we can give example after example. Facebook was not the first. MySpace was the one before it. But Mark Zuckerberg had that, you know, charisma or drive, and he destroyed MySpace. And we can use example after example. Google wasn't the first search engine, okay? But the two founders of Google had that passion to make it succeed. So you don't invest in ideas. Yes, you have to have a good idea, but you have to invest in people. The biggest mistakes I've made was when I invested in a great idea and the people couldn't drive it. But if you have the right people, they could succeed almost regardless of the idea.
Is this your personal investment mentoring philosophy, or do you think that this resonates globally?
This is absolutely my philosophy. Mm-hmm. But I think if you were to Google or talk to any investor in startups, they'll tell you the same thing.
Well, if it is the people, let's talk about the people in the geography that you've chosen to bed yourself, which is Southeast Asia. You've been here a long time. It's based in Singapore, but a lot of the work you're now doing is outside of Singapore, in Myanmar, Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia. What are some of the characteristics of Southeast Asian entrepreneurs and startup types? And what are some of the early kind of observations, and how is that changing?
Let's take a little bit of a step back first. Everybody knows about China, okay? 1. How many billion people? And everybody knows about India, 1 billion people. Many people don't think about Southeast Asia because there are many countries involved and you've got different languages. But if I were to ask you what percentage of the people in China speak Chinese, and by Chinese I mean Mandarin, do you know what the number is? What percentage speak Mandarin?
I don't know, 80%?
No, it's under 50%.
Oh, is it really?
Under 50%. There are something like 18 official languages in China. Okay, you've got 100 million people speaking Cantonese, for example. Okay, and the same thing is true in India, where even though you have Hindi as the national language, more often than not, people speak regional languages. They speak one language in Delhi, another one in Bombay, another one in Chennai. Okay, so even China and India, which are seen as monolithic things, are really very, very regional. So you have Southeast Asia, which combined is maybe 700 million people. So almost the same size, and certainly of the same magnitude as China and India. But you've got individual countries.
And when you're speaking of the Southeast Asia, we're talking about the five ASEAN countries.
No, there's 10 countries.
Primary markets. Yeah, but Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, Thailand.
Vietnam.
There's Vietnam.
See, now you have to add Vietnam and Myanmar. Now, the first thing is you've got obviously different languages in each of these countries. Okay, so Singapore, the main language is English. You've got Bahasa in Malaysia and Indonesia, Thai in Thailand, Myanmar. Okay, so you've got different languages. Secondly, you've got different religions, and religion in Asia is very much linked with culture. It's not necessarily where and how you pray, but your whole culture, your whole identity is wrapped up in your religion. Okay, so the Philippines is Catholic, Indonesia is Muslim. Thailand, Myanmar, Laos, Cambodia are Buddhist. Vietnam, let's call it Confucius. So you've got four dominant religions in the region. So you've got a lot of distinctions. And so it's hard to say Southeast Asia is like this or it's not like that, because you've got a lot of different dynamics going on.
But what you're pointing to is the fragmentation of Southeast Asia, which makes it a more difficult region or sub-region to address versus China or India, which are larger, relatively more homogenous markets. Is that correct?
Absolutely, which is why a lot of the focus has gone to China and India with startups. So if you look at startup money coming into Asia, China gets the bulk of it, India second, and Southeast Asia's third.
But, and yet here's the wave. We see now moving because of the slowdown in China, because of some structural issues in India, now money is lining up against Southeast Asia, and here you are sitting pretty.
Exactly. So now people are starting to say China and India are tapped out. The economies are slowing down. The valuations are getting extremely high for startups. Let's look at Southeast Asia, where you have extremely vibrant economies. You have economies going from developing and emerging to developed markets. And you've got a very vibrant startup scene. Now, the startup scene has been strangled for lack of money, but suddenly you have the VCs and the angel groups starting to look at Southeast Asia, and the money's starting to come in.
There's two issues. There's the money, there's the funding, not enough capital available, although we'll talk about Singapore in a minute, which is a little bit of a different story. But then you also have, as I mentioned, this kind of fragmentation. You don't have the economies of scale, the addressable markets that you need in internet-based service or internet-based startups. Is that correct?
And that's correct. But there's another dynamic, this is more of a qualitative thing. Let's talk about the people side of it. I would say in America, there is a, everybody knows about Silicon Valley today. In the 80s, it was, a bunch of crazy kids working out of their garage. But today, it's very aspirational. In Asia, you still have a lot of the old-fashioned values because Asia is 50 years, let's say, behind America. And so there's still the desire, I want to have a good job at an important company and get a company car and have a good title and have a nice office. There's still all of those values.
From the millennial crowd or more?
The earlier crowd, but even the millennials, a lot of the millennials are starting to do that. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, the hardest thing for me is somebody trying to hire people for startups. I'm not talking about, the founder, but, you're trying to get people to join your company and you can't afford to pay them. And you've got a 30-year-old guy who's a hotshot at some big company making a great salary. And I say to him, you have to give up your salary, but I'll give you shares in this company. They're not interested. Okay, by and large, they are not interested. The biggest problem I have is getting people to join a startup.
Is that changing at all, Eric?
Slowly. But it's very hard to make a change. And there's also this feeling that, shares in the company, might have value in 5 years, might not have value. I got a job today. It's paying me now. I'm raising my family. I'm taking care of my parents. I really can't throw that away. The idea of taking care of your parents, it's such an important thing in the Asian culture. In America, you're 18, you go off to university, and it's an embarrassment if you ever have to go home and live with your parents. Yeah. It's a right to show that you're independent, that you live on your own, right? But in Asia, you live with your parents. Even when you get married, you still live with your parents. You're required to take care of them as they get old. Now, if you've got a job and you're making good money, why are you going to throw that away to join a startup?
That was the second part of my interview with Eric Rosenkranz, former vice chairman of Focus Media China, now founder and CEO of advisory firm E3. For all our episodes and for more information about the Singapore incubator where I spoke to Eric, head to www.insideasiapodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Stein, reminding you to keep looking through open windows. You never know who or what might be staring back.